Chapter 6. The Lama, who was our new teacher, pushed aside the lectern and sat down in the lotus position in front of us, sitting on the slightly raised platform which was present at all Tibetan lecture rooms. At our meals in our dining halls, we had high lecterns at which a reader either sat or stood during meals, because at all times when we ate, we were read to so that our minds should be filled with spiritual thoughts, while our stomachs became filled with sampa. It was not considered correct to eat and think of the food. It was the custom for formal lectures to be given with the lecturer standing at the lectern, and, as we were quick to appreciate the fact that our new teacher was sitting in front of us, showed us that he was a different sort of man. "Well," he said, "you have just been dealing with right mindfulness, and I hope that you are in the right frame of mind, because the mind is the cause of most of man's distress. Physical desires can be very troublesome, particularly in a monastic community, particularly when the inmates are all celibate. Thus, it is necessary to control the mind, to create right mindfulness, because in creating right mindfulness, we are able to avoid the unhappiness which arises when we desire all the things which we know quite well we cannot have. You know that the Buddha always taught that men particularly were often led astray by what one might term visual impact. Men, the average man, tends to idealize women." He looked at one rather big boy and smiled as he said, "I know that a young gentleman such as you, who sometimes accompanies an older monk in the marketplace, might at times deserve to be called swivel eyes. But the Buddha taught that such things are not good for the monk, because the desire is father to the action. The thought makes one do the things which one knows to be wrong." He looked at each of us and smiled as he said, "We should take the middle way, however, and not be too good or too bad. There is a story of a certain wayfarer who was traveling along a road. Sometime before, he had seen a very beautiful young woman pass, and he was most anxious to make her acquaintance. Unfortunately, he had had to step aside into the bushes for a purpose which we need not discuss, and he feared that in the interval the young woman must have passed him by. He saw an old Buddhist monk coming along and stopped him, saying, 'Will you tell me, honorable master, have you seen a very beautiful young woman passing this way in your travels?' The old monk looked blankly at him and replied, 'A beautiful young woman? Oh, that I cannot tell you. I've been trained in right mindfulness. Therefore it is that I can only tell you that a set of bones passed me some time ago. Whether it was that of a man or woman, I cannot say, for it was of no interest to me.'" The Lama chuckled as he said, "That is right mindfulness carried beyond all reasonable limits, carried, in fact, to an absurd extent. However, let us carry on with the subject, which is very, very much misunderstood." He went on to tell us that the Eightfold Path had an objective under which those who followed that path would attain a very desired end, would attain nirvana. Nirvana actually means the cessation of craving, the end of resentment and covetousness. The end of covetousness and the other lusts of the body would enable a man or woman to attain a state of bliss. Nirvana is liberation from the body, liberation from lusts and gluttonies of the flesh. It does not by any means imply the cessation of all experience, nor does it mean the cessation of all knowledge, nor the cessation of all life. It is incorrect to say that nirvana means existing in a state of nothingness. That is an error which has been perpetrated through ignorant people talking about things which they do not at all understand. Nirvana is freedom from lust, freedom from the various hungers of the flesh. Nirvana is not just blissful contemplation. It is instead a fulfillment of spiritual knowledge and liberation from all bodily desires. The state of nirvana is being in a pure state, pure so far as lack of lusts for physical things are concerned. But even when one has attained to nirvana, that is freedom from flesh desires. One still goes on to learn spiritual things and to advance in other planes of existence. Buddhists believe in the round of becoming. They believe that mankind is born to earth, lives on earth, and then dies, and then comes back to earth in a different body, that is, reborn to earth, so that lessons not learned during a past life can be assimilated. Nirvana is not a place. It's not a place that you can pin down on a map. It's a state of mind, a condition of mind. It is the condition of being thoughtful. Thoughtfulness is one of the chief virtues of a good Buddhist, while thoughtlessness is a bored. Nirvana does not mean the loss of personal consciousness at the cessation of life upon earth. It means quite the reverse. There is also a further nirvana, which in the Indian language is called parinirvana. A good Buddhist, said our Lama teacher, is a truly happy person, a person who's concerned with helping others, a person who has thought for others. The good Buddhist does not respect or recognize the titles or castes existing in countries such as India. For a man does not attain to a state of happiness by the estate of his parents. A prince could be unhappy, while a beggar could be happy. Birth does not enable one to discover how to defeat the suffering. The state of one's parents' purse had nothing to do with it. The only way to seek liberation from unwholesome desires is by following the practical Eightfold Path, which gives one self-knowledge. And as one has self-knowledge, one can have lasting happiness. The Lama looked at each of us and said, I suppose you think that we Buddhists have the greatest number of followers of any religion in the world. you think we are the most important. Well, that's not correct, because at the present time, only 1/5 of the population of this world are Buddhists. We have Buddhists in Thailand, Ceylon, Burma, China, Japan, Korea, Tibet, and a certain number in India. There are many forms of Buddhism, and they all spring from the same source. Wherefore, it is clear that there should not be friction between us, springing, as we do, from the same parent. We can each think in our own way. Much later in our lectures, we shall deal with the uses of religion. But for the moment, I want you to recite the refuges. The three refuges. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the doctrine. I take refuge in the order. The Lama said, "You boys must say that in the morning and before retiring at night. You must get it impressed upon your subconscious. You can call it a symbolization of the great renunciation which the founder of Buddhism made when he left the family palace and took up his monk's robe. You boys," he continued, "will be renouncing the lures of the flesh. You will be training to be young men of good character, of good conduct, young men of pure thought, for in the days that shall come upon our country, days of sorrow, days of overshadowing evil, for terrible things shall come to pass in our beloved country. It will be necessary for young men of good character to go out into what to us is the great unknown, and to keep our culture alive. Therefore, it is that you of this generation must study and purify yourselves, for we of the older generation shall not be able to follow you." He told us, "In your travels you will meet many Zen Buddhists. You'll wonder if their austerities are necessary, for to the Zen Buddhist, all those who teach and all that which teaches, such as books or scriptures, are only pointers like a finger outstretched, pointing the path that one shall take. Think of the people you've seen. Think as you look down upon our pilgrims walking around the ring road. Observe how, when some guide or gypsy points to a thing, like one of us at our windows, how a pilgrim's eyes invariably follow and look at the pointing finger, rather than the object at which it is pointed. It is a fact that the ignorant always look at the pointing finger rather than the direction that the finger indicates. This is a fact which was known to the sect of Buddhism, which became known as the Zen Buddhists. It is their belief that one can only know the truth by one's personal experience of truth. Truth cannot be known by just listening to the spoken word, nor by reading the printed page. One can only profit by actual personal experiences. One is enjoined to read, to study the scriptures, and to listen with attention to the learned lectures of wise men. But all the printed words and all the written words must serve merely as fuel for the workings of one's own mind, so that when one gets an experience, one can relate that experience to great truths as propounded by others. He smiled and said, "All this means that you cannot get far by being a mere theorist. You have to be a practical man, as well as a student of the written word. It is stated that one picture is worth more than 1,000 words, but I say that one experience is worth more than 1,000 pictures. He hesitated for a moment and turned and looked out the window. My heart leapt because I thought that perhaps he would see my guide, the Lama Mengyar Dondop, returning from the Wild Rose Fence Lamasery. But no, he just turned back to us again and said, "I am going to tell you something which undoubtedly will shock you and make you think that Zen Buddhists are uncultured savages, and sacrilegious savages at that. Some time ago, in Japan, there was a very famous teacher indeed, a man who was revered for his high ideals, for his profound knowledge, and for the austere manner of his living. Students came from all over the Eastern world to bow at that master's feet and study under him. One day he was giving a very special lecture in one of the ceremonial temples, a temple adorned by many statues of the 1,000 Buddhas, statues cunningly carved from rare exotic woods. The teacher had the enthralled attention of his students, and then he paused in the middle of his lecture, and his students held their breath, wondering what he was going to say, because he had, deservedly, a reputation for being very, very eccentric. As this wise man turned aside and seized the nearest of the wooden Buddhas and threw it in the fire, the students rose in shocked horror. For a moment there was a babble of conversation, protests, waving hands and scuffling feet, but the wise man stood calmly with his back to the fire, stood with his back to the blazing statue of the Buddha. When the commotion had ceased, he said that everyone had statues in their minds. Everyone sets up ornaments, idols, useless things, which occupy space in the mind just as useless wooden idols occupy space in a temple. As he said, the only way to progress is to burn up the clutter in one's mind, destroy that which impedes progress. The great teacher turned and rubbed a finger over one of the higher Buddhas. He turned back to the class and said, "Here there be dust, dust upon a Buddha, but that is not so bad as dust upon the mind. Let us destroy carved images. Let us destroy false ideas that live within us, for unless one clears out one's untidy mind, as one clears out an untidy attic, one cannot progress and go on to the higher reaches of the path." Our Lama teacher laughed outright at our shocked expressions. He said, "Oh, you are a conservative lot. Wait until you get out to some of the other lamaseries. Wait until you move among the people. You'll find that some have no use for the teachings of religion, and you will find yet others who wash out their mouth before speaking the name of Buddha, wash their mouth so that their mouth shall be clean before uttering a sacred name. But these are extremes, those who make a fetish of it, and those who have no use for religion. Religion is a discipline which is only of use if one uses common sense, moderation, and the middle way, and then religion can solve all of one's problems. I do not know, but I suppose I must have grunted or made some sign which attracted his attention, for he hesitated a moment and then slowly came over and stood in front of me and looked down. "Lobsang," he said, "you appear to be very troubled. You've had a most trying experience today, but from your expression I am sure that there is more troubling you than that, and I am sure also that it is even more serious than that your guide has not returned and will not return this day. Tell me what it is." I wish the floor would open up and drop me all the way through, right down into one of the volcanic chambers, because I had to admit I had been thinking rather unusual things. To be quite blunt, I was heartily sick of the way I had to live, and I thought that now was the time, perhaps, let us get it over with. "Honorable Master," I said with some trepidation, "it is true that I am dissatisfied. My mind is in conflict. My thoughts are in turmoil, for I'm being driven to take a course of action which is not at all in accordance with my own desires. I have been sorely troubled, and as I sat upon the golden roof, struggling with the wind, thinking that death awaited me, I was glad, because I thought that death would bring the end of my problems." The Lama teacher looked at me with sympathy. He drew his robe around him and sat on the floor beside me, crossing his legs and settling himself in the lotus posture. "Lobsang," he said, "let us discuss this problem, and I suggest that we discuss it with this class, because I have no doubt that many of the young men here are similarly troubled at some time or other. I've been at the Patala a long, long time, and perhaps your own problems now may have been my problems in days gone by." "Honorable teacher," I replied, "I have no choice. I had to leave my wealthy home. I was driven out by my parents, who were very powerful people indeed, and I was told that I was to be trained in the priesthood. Because I came of a high family, I had to undergo more trials and tribulations than had I come from a low family. I had more to learn. I had more to suffer. My leg was burned to the bone through no fault of mine. Both my legs were broken when I was blown off the mountain in a gale. But although I could barely hobble, although I suffer constant pain, I still have to attend classes. Now, honorable teacher, I have never wanted to be a monk, but I've had no choice in what I wanted. I've been forced to do it. Religion offers me nothing." The Lama looked at me with a lot of understanding and said, "But, Lobsang, these are early days. Religion will offer you a lot when you understand the workings of the middle way and the rules of this life and the life beyond. Then you will become tranquil, and you will understand much more what life really is. But at your present stage, what do you want to be?" I said, "I looked out from the golden roof, and I saw the boatman on the happy river, and I thought, what a free life that is! How pleasant, just paddling backwards and forwards on a river which everyone loves, meeting interesting people who come from India, people who are going to China, people who are going beyond the mountains to return at some time with strange knowledge and strange artifacts. But I am a boy stuck here, subject to discipline, not able to do anything that I want to do, always having to obey orders, always having to learn things which I'm not interested, always being told that my life will be hard, but that I am working for a special purpose, that I'm going to do a special task. I stopped and wiped my brow with my sleeve and then continued, "Why do I always have to have such hardship?" The teacher put a hand on my shoulder and said, "All life is like this classroom. You come here, some of you reluctantly, some of you gladly, but you all come here to learn things, and each of you must learn at your own rate, because no one, no teacher, can force your development, for to do so would mean that you had an imperfect knowledge of the subject. You have to progress at your own rate, fast or slow, according to your own capabilities, according to your own desire for knowledge. All life is like a classroom. You come to this life as you come to this class, but when you leave this classroom in several minutes' time, it will be the same as dying to this life, dying to the classroom. Perhaps tomorrow you'll go to a different classroom, which is much the same as being reborn. Reborn in a different body, in a different condition, with different circumstances. You do not know what the teacher is going to teach you. You do not know why the teacher is going to teach you. But when, in years to come, you go out into the great world beyond our range of mountains, you will find that the things you have learned in this classroom and in other classrooms will help you enormously in ways which you cannot at present comprehend." That is what my guide, the Lama Mingyar Dandup, always tells me, I replied, "but I still do not know how I can reconcile myself to do something which makes me unhappy." The teacher looked about to see what the other boys were doing, but the others were all intent. They were interested because it seemed that they all had problems similar to my own. We boys had all been put in lamasaries without any choice of our own. In my own case, I entered when I was 7. These boys were listening now. We were all, in fact, like people groping in total darkness, hoping for a ray of light to guide us. Our teacher continued, "You must decide what paths there are open to you. You, Lobsang, can stay here and be a monk, or you can leave and be a boatman, or a maker of kites, or travel to lands beyond the mountains. But you cannot be all of them at the same time. You must decide what you're going to be. If you're going to be a boatman, then leave this lamasery now, and think no more of this lamasery. Think no more of being a monk. Think only of being a boatman. But if you're going to be a monk, as indeed is your destiny, then forget about being a boatman. Devote the whole of your thought to being a monk. Devote the whole of your thought to studying how to be a good monk. And the more you think about being a good monk, the easier it will be for you." One of the other boys broke in, saying excitedly, But, honorable master, I too had to enter a lamasery against my own wishes. I wanted to go to Nepal to live, because I think I would be happier in Nepal. Our lama teacher looked quite serious, looked as if this was a matter of extreme importance, instead of being the idle fancies of boys who didn't know what they were talking about. He replied gravely, "But do you know the Nepalese people very well? Have you had any real experience of them, besides the very few you have met? Do you know of the lower types of Nepalese people? If not, if you have not frequently been in their homes, then you cannot know if you would like them. I say that if you want to stay here in Tibet, then you should devote all your thought to Tibet. But if you want to go to Nepal, then you should leave Tibet now and go to Nepal, and think no more of Tibet. For if one divides one's thoughts, one divides one's forces. We can have a good stream of thought or force, or we can have the scattered raindrops which cover a wide area but have no force. Each of you must decide what you want to do, what you want to be. And having decided, then each of you must concentrate wholeheartedly and with undivided mind on achieving what you want to be. For if you decide to go to Nepal with one half of your mind, and the other half decides to stay in Tibet, then you are in a state of indecision the whole time. You are worried the whole time, and you cannot at any time then obtain peace of mind or tranquility. That is one of the great forces of the world, one of the great laws which you must remember. Divide the enemy, and you can rule the enemy. Stay united yourself, and you can defeat a divided enemy. The enemy can well be indecision, fear, and uncertainty." We all looked at each other and we thought how well this particular teacher understood us. It was so very much better having a man who was a man to whom we could talk, and who would talk back with us and not just at us. We thought of our Indian teacher, how supercilious he was. I said, "Honorable Master, I have a question. Why is it that some lamas are so very cruel, and others are so understanding and so kind?" The teacher smiled a little and said, "Why, Lobsang, it's rather late at night to delve into such weighty matters, but I promise you that we will deal with such things, and we will also deal with the uses and abuses of religions. But I think now we have worked long enough for one day, so let us each go about his own business." He stood up, and all the boys stood up with him. The lama saw that I was having difficulty, so he bent over, put an arm around me, and just helped me to my feet as easily, as calmly, as if he was used to doing it every day of his life. "Go along now, boys," he said, "otherwise you'll be stumbling and falling in the darkness of the corridors, and we don't want any more people who have temporary leg injuries." The boys all rushed away full of happiness because we had finished rather more early than usual. The lama teacher turned to me before leaving and said, "Lobsang, Your guide will be returning in the morning. I doubt if you will see him until the afternoon, or even until the evening, because he has to make a special report to the Inmost One and to the members of the Upper Council. But he has sent a message that he's thinking about you, and the Inmost One has sent a message to him saying how pleased His Holiness is with you, and Lob Sang, your guide has something for you. With that, he smiled, gave me a light pat on the shoulder, turned and laughed. I stood for a moment or two wondering why the Inmost One should be pleased with me when I was so tattered and battered, and when in the eyes of the others I had caused so much trouble. And I also wondered what my beloved guide had for me. I could hardly bear to think what he might have, because never in my life had I had any gift bestowed upon me. I turned and stumped out of the room just as the old cleaning monk entered. He greeted me in a friendly fashion and inquired most kindly about my legs. I told him that they were slowly mending, and he said, I was cleaning in the Lama's quarters today, and I have heard them saying that you are destined for great things. I have heard them say that the Holy One is very, very pleased with you. I exchanged a few more words, helped the old man light the butter lamps, and then I went on my way, going down and down, reluctantly passing the corridor to the kitchen, and going instead into one of the minor temples. I wanted to be alone. I wanted to think, wanted to meditate on the past, and contemplate upon the future. In a lamasery, there is very little privacy for an acolyte, or, more accurately, a chela, because chela is the Buddhist term. And if we ever were overcome with sorrow or problems, then the only place we could be alone was in one of the minor temples, where we could get behind one of the larger of the sacred figures, where no one would disturb us. So I went down and entered a dimly lit temple, where the butter lamps were sputtering, showing that someone had got water in with the butter. The lamps were sputtering and sending up gouts of black smoke, which were leaving marks upon the walls, leaving marks on a tanka. I walked on and on, past the smoldering incense burners, and turned to my favorite statue and sat down beneath its shadow. As I sat there, there was a prrr, prrr, and a friendly black head butted me in the small of my back, and then great furry feet made their way onto my lap and started kneading, while the cat went on purring louder and louder. For some moments I played with the old cat, rubbing his fur, pulling his tail, and tweaking his ears, and all the time he purred louder and louder. Then suddenly, like a lamp going out, his head dropped and he fell asleep on the lap of my robe. I clasped my hands and thought of all the incidents of my life, thought of all the difficulties. I pondered about the present, thinking how easy it was for people to give one platitudes about religion, thinking how easy it was for one to say the rules of right living. But it was not so easy when one was a small boy and had just been forced into a career or vocation without the slightest inclination or desire for such a career or vocation. So thinking, I must have drifted off to sleep, sitting upright as we often did when we slept. The old cat slept, and I slept as well, and time passed us by. The lengthening shadows outside became darker and darker. The sun ran its course and disappeared. Soon, over the edge of the mountains, peered the face of the silver moon, and all the houses of Lhasa had little butter lamps flickering behind their windows. And I and the old cat, we slept in the shadow of the sacred figure. End of chapter 6.